Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach. And this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 39. Note that different number. We'll get to that in a moment. Here at the New Republic, encourage you, as always, to follow us at Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. Grierson, now, you and I, obviously, we've been friends for a long time. And we have a history together. And I would say if there were a Mount Rushmore of our influences, like some people, like I might have Kurt Cobain a little higher on there and you might not. You might have like Justin Timberlake or Jimmy Fallon on there and I might not have
that. Okay, that's enough.
But if we were, sorry.
Yeah,
if
we were the Jimmy Fallon thing, I'm not going to allow that to pass.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, sorry. If we were to have, however, our Rushmore, I would say that our Rushmore would be David Letterman.
Correct.
Woody Allen.
Correct.
Roger Ebert.
Correct.
And Bob Dylan would probably be our fourth. So I'm curious, Grierson, when you heard, this is a big internet kerfuffle, when you heard that Bob Dylan had won the Nobel Prize for Literature, what did you think?
I thought it was an excellent choice. And I also just think in general, what's funny about like a group like the Nobel awards, it's always sort of funny. I feel like people take those seriously as if it's like from another planet of wise elders. Like somehow it's supposed to mean more. Like even like when Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize, there was sort of this thought of maybe he was too young. He was maybe kind of undeserving, but there's also a sense that this like, shouldn't the Nobel Prize board know better? They're the Nobel Prize. No, they're human beings too, just like everybody else. But I was completely okay with him winning, as I would have been if Philip Roth had won, who I also think is very deserving.
Well, I personally care a lot more about Bob Dylan than I do the Nobel Prize for Literature. So you guys fight it out, people. Dylan's awesome. So that's all my general thoughts on this. Oh, this is the Grizzlies Podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us on SoundCloud on thenewrepublic.com. And when you go to email us, GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com. And when you go to iTunes and give us a review, give us the name of a movie that you would like us to talk about. And we review it in our reboot section. This week, we have one reboot movie. Comes to us from The Podcast Liker, which is, I hope that's just, I think that's pretty good. That's pretty straight to the point. I can't believe his parents named him that, or her parents.
They just had a feeling that someday podcasts were going to take off and their son or daughter were going to love them.
Exactly. Or no, like them. Just like
them. Just like them. Just okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, how many stars do we get from podcasts?
Five stars. Oh, yeah, five stars. So this seems more than liking, frankly, if you ask me. The podcast, ellipses, is extremely good. I like that the subject line kept us in suspense as to what would be coming. I'm not a huge film buff, the podcast liker says, and I don't get to the movies that often, but this is still one of my favorite podcasts. Grierson and Leach are both very thoughtful and articulate film critics with great chemistry together, and their discussions are one of the highlights of my week. For the reboot section, I'd love to hear your guys review Pink Floyd The Wall. It's one of my favorite movies, but one I never hear discussed by critics. So, in our reboot section, we will be discussing Pink Floyd The Wall. However, we have three movies, new movies to talk about. Unfortunately, I've only seen one of them, so this is another one of those podcasts now where Grierson just soliloquies. These are like bad guy confessing length, like just 15, 20 minutes of him just explaining everything about these movies before I see them. The two movies he'll be talking about are Christine and Certain Women. Now, these are two of the movies I am looking forward to most in the world right now, so I'll be seeing them immediately. But unfortunately, I actually have a screener for Certain Women at my desk right now. I'm looking right at it. Hello, screener for Certain Women.
Hello,
Hello.
Oh, we both did it. That's great. That's the type of award-winning chemistry that we're known for right there.
Exactly. The podcast liker is onto us. So so he'll be discussing both of those. And I will hopefully see those next week. So we'll be able to talk about that a little bit further. But first, we're going to kick off with the big new release and the number one box office hit of the weekend. We're going to talk about The Accountant.
How did you get into financial consulting? My dad was an accountant. You know, he had the whole shtick. The dorky pocket protector.
I have a pocket protector.
That's a nice one.
Do you like puzzles? Tell me what you see. Was taken 3 years ago by an undercover agent.
It's the same person.
He was spotted in Tehran, Tel Aviv, and Naples. This guy risks his life uncooking the books for some of the scariest people on the planet. Drug cartels, arms brokers, money launderers, assassins. Who survives this kind of clientele? Imagine the secrets this guy has.
What are you doing here?
Who are you?
All right, so The Accountant is directed by Gavin O'Connor, who did Warrior and Miracle. So they at least finally added a definitive article before his titles. At last, he's evolving, you see. It stars Ben Affleck as Christian Wolfe, aka many, many other things. He is, in fact, an accountant. I don't know if he's the accountant, but he's certainly the accountant of this movie. I don't know if accountants get together and decide which one is the, though I suppose if they did get together and vote for one, it would be this one, because this guy is really good with guns. So I imagine most accountants are not. So they are listening to whatever this guy says. He is, Ben Affleck plays Christian Wolfe, or many other names. He is a mild-mannered accountant who, as we are informed three-quarters of the way through the movie, has a high-functioning autism, which is to say he's very distant and very seems to be obsessive-compulsive. This is not a documentary about autism, to say the least. He's kind of under investigation by J.K. Simmons, who plays this Treasury secretary, this Treasury agent who's trying to find out what his deal is. Because Christian Wolfe is an accountant to like evil dictators and helps them run their books. But also, as we learn through in a series of flashbacks, he was raised by this army father, along with his brother, to be this super killer and the super crazed, being able to defend himself and kill like no one else in the world. He gets hired by John Lithgow, who runs a robotics company, who believes there's been money stolen from his company because he's so highly recommended. He goes to work to find out where, I think, $69 million, however many million dollars, has been taken from the company, where he comes across Anna Kendrick, who is a lower-level associate who's discovered this. That leads him into all sorts of craziness and insanity as people try to kill him. John Bernthal shows up as an assassin who seems to be trying to kill everyone for a mysterious client. And there's just all sorts of stuff going on in The Accountant. Now, to me, one of the major issues with The Accountant, Grierson, is there is so much going on in this movie. One of the things I talked about in my review for The New Republic is this is one of those, it's so frustrating. This movie annoys me more than it actually probably should. Because let's think about it. This is a Warner Brothers movie. This is a big studio movie, a big release. How much time do we, and frankly, audiences, whenever you hear people do the annoying TV is more relevant than movies thing that they do, they're often, the thing they often bring up is, well, all these movies are all on comic books, they're all on pre-existing properties and all this other stuff. The Accountant is a movie for adults, rated R, a new character, a new script, a new thing. This is the type of thing that people claim that they are wanting all the time from movies, an original movie for adults about adults by adult themes. Which is really frustrating because it appears to be written by a child. and one of the things that's very frustrating about The Accountant is it's so hard to get movies, to get studios to make a movie like this. I found myself thinking of No Way Out. Remember that movie with Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman?
I do remember that.
Sean Young. Yes. And like that was like, that's the type of movie, I feel like a lot of times we do a reboot section, we talk about movies, they just don't make movies like that anymore. And it feels like No Way Out is this crackerjack filler. There's some problems with that movie. But that's the kind of like, no hold, like, just brick and mortar, pick them up, set them down, thriller that Hollywood just doesn't make anymore. This is The Accountant is about as close as you're going to get for them to do that kind of movie, which is why it's so frustrating that this movie is so disjointed and so confusing. The lead character is a series of ticks in search of any sort of actual character. And the plot is full of so many stories. Every supporting character has way too much on their plate. There's all these things that collide. And it keeps, I feel like the first half hour hangs in okay, but it keeps adding layer upon layer of like very confused, very frustrating plot. And it made me realize, oh, well, this is really frustrating. We finally get this movie by adults for adults. And it's a total mess.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those movies I feel like it tries to split the difference between two types of movies. It could very easily be. One is kind of the John Wick-esque, we're just going to go crazy and it's going to be over the top and we're going to really embrace this hard R, super violent, badass kind of thriller. That's one movie this movie could be. The other movie is, well, no, we're actually going to take the premise seriously, give it emotional stakes, give you a sense of these being really kind of lived in, believable characters and emotional drama and a sort of like a family element in terms of Ben Affleck's character and the background of him and the stakes and what goes on. And instead, what the movie does is try to be both. And I think that's actually the problem. I would have preferred the former. I think I would have preferred if this movie had just been kind of ludicrous and had owned that. Because if you are going to have a premise of Ben Affleck plays an accountant who is autistic, but is also a killing machine, I think you have to know that that is ludicrous. And you have to sort of say, yes, yes, we know. But it's going to be, we're going to make it really fun. And I feel like Gavin O'Connor, who, you know, I thought Warrior was kind of overwrought. I thought Miracle was terrific. I feel like he hasn't made a really good movie kind of since then. This movie would have benefited from like the John Wick guys making it, because I feel like this movie needs to have, and when Ben Affleck, once we find out, oh no, he's this ass kicking like killing machine who's really, really good with a gun, and he starts killing people at point blank range, you feel the movie come to life in a way that goes, oh, the rest of this felt really kind of plodding and sort of ponderous, but this, like, the action sequences are kind of fun in this movie.
Yeah, this is what this movie wanted to be in the first place.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the whole idea about, you know, they don't make movies like this anymore. Yeah, it definitely kind of feels that way, but this is a movie that's over 2 hours long and also thinks that when Anna Kendrick shows up, they should actually have, like, this sort of kind of unrequited love story between the two of them, which as soon as that happened, I thought to myself, oh no, they've misjudged what kind of movie this is. Like they actually sort of invest emotionally in that. I think, oh no, someone needs to tell the people who are making this movie that they don't understand the movie that they're making. I don't want to reveal like the plot twist at the end because I feel like there are some people who are listening to this who haven't seen the movie yet. But it's so incredibly stupid that the only way it works is if you go, oh, no. Oh, hell no, they did it. But the movie doesn't do that. The movie actually kind of goes like, no, this actually happened. And it's just, I there's a part of me that enjoys, especially for a studio movie, the ludicrousness of how much, in terms of how much of this movie kind of operates in the level of being just kind of ridiculous and kind of going with it. But there's not enough of that. And so for me, I can't say I hated the movie, but I kept thinking, oh, you guys are so close. You're so close. You just don't know. And I think it also goes into Ben Affleck's performance, which manners and mannerisms and tics, I completely agree with. And it also just feels like the point of the performance is not to sell us on the complexity of what it's like to have autism, because if that's what you're trying to do, you have created the wrong vehicle to do that. I mean, I guess I give the movie credit for wanting, I put that word in quotes, wanting to be sort of sensitive to people with autism and trying to understand what that's like. But the rest of the movie can't sustain that kind of attempt at being realistic. It's almost better if it was much less sensitive and just said, yeah, he's autistic, but he's really awesome, and just kind of left it at that. So to me, it's sort of a muddle and I kind of got a kick out of it, but not enough to recommend.
Yeah, the autism thing, I thought, it's weird. One of the things when I was walking through the plot that I mentioned, it's three quarters of the movie before we realize what actually his, like, that he is a high-functioning autism, is I thought that's what they were doing. I thought they were just not going to give us a name for what his thing was.
I felt the same way.
Yeah, yeah. I thought they were just going to be like, okay, this is just a thing, and they're not going to try to get, like, serious with this or anything that, and I felt like that probably, I feel like that would have actually been a lot more appropriate. Like, I think it's strange that they actually give a name to it and then try to get somewhat serious with the clinic that his father takes to. Also, I don't think it quite nails the father past stuff in the past. Like, I feel like, because we get like a lot of flashback scenes talking about kind of how the accountant came to be and what's going on with that. And I feel like some of that could work. And I know he has a brother in the flashback scenes, and I get a little bit, that's where you start to feel like we talked about Warrior. I feel like Warrior is, I like it a little bit more than you do, but I still, and to me the strongest stuff in that movie is the brother bond. Like, that's a big part of that movie. The touches on that a little bit here, but really, like, the movie has so many things it needs to juggle that we get like two-thirds of the way for the movie, and J.K. Simmons, and forgive me, I forget the name of the actress that plays his that plays the co-investigator. They're both given like way too much backstory. They're both given like way more details about their character than we need to be. Like, why J.K. Simmons is basically blackmailing this agent to help him with the case for reasons that frankly aren't apparently clear, and just seem to have just given us one extra thing that we didn't really need. There's a lot of that. And then we've learned J.K. Simmons' backstory about why he cares so much about this case. It just keeps piling on and piling on and piling on. And it's just a movie that really doesn't quite know what it is.
Yeah. That actress' name, I had to look it up, is Cynthia Adai Robinson. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's in the, her performance and J.K. Simmons' performance, I think, yeah, also speak to this idea of, guys, don't overthink this. Like, this should be, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's a weird thing because I want to be very clear about this. I don't want to make it seem like this should be a glib action movie about a guy with autism and not be sensitive to those things. But the movies, its guts and its core and its heart are about being sort of pulpy. And the rest of it then like counteracts that movie that it should be. And so therefore it doesn't work. And so the movie, I think, thinks it has all these like great dramatic, it has like this gravitas that all of the characters in some ways are kind of connected in the story in a deeper way than we or they initially think. But again, this movie should be 95 minutes long and be really fun. And you should have people comparing it to like a John Wick or some of these other more kind of like pure B movie action kind of things. Vulture had a great piece. I don't know if you saw it, where they had 20 questions, and it's basically like 20 questions they have about the movie now that they've seen it. And I don't want to talk about those questions because some of them are spoilers, but so many of those, you read that and you go, yeah, like these are just basic things the movie doesn't answer, and the movie should answer those questions opposed to piling on the significance and the connections between different characters. One other thing I just want to mention really fast is, you know, I like Anna Kendrick a lot in general, but this to me is a type of movie where I feel like I don't know why she bothers, because I feel like movies like this just simply don't know what to do with her. I think when she is at her best, she is, she can play kind of traditional girlfriend roles, or, you know, like, you know, even saying like Up in the Air, where she's like the smart new person in the office place, something like that. She always has sort of like a cockeyed way of playing these kind of traditional lame female supporting character roles that make those roles kind of fun. Something like this, you can sense that she is trying to bring something to the movie, but the movie just has nothing for her to do. And then when it kind of moves towards, oh, she has feelings for the accountant, and maybe the accountant has feelings for her, but he cannot, because he cannot be close to anybody, partly because of his autism and other reasons, you think, again, which is sort of my overall theme of the movie, gee, this seems a lot tougher in terms of the way it's trying to do than it really needs to be.
Yeah, it's also, again, you never know with a studio movie what kind of stuff goes into this. But there's a little bit of it that feels like this, even with the trailer for this movie, it had Radiohead. It was supposed to be like, this is very, it felt like it was a very serious movie. But it also feels like it's starting to start some, trying to start some sort of franchise.
Yes.
Like it's kind of strange, which is, you know, so, and I feel like it can't decide. It's almost as if they like had this kind of character study about, or they had this story about this guy. And then they cast Ben Affleck. They're like, I don't know, maybe it'll be a hit. Maybe we'll have a series of accountant movies where he just goes out and kicks people's ass. And that tension and that confusion is evident throughout.
Yeah. I think what's really weird about Ben Affleck's career, which is, I think, constantly be kind of fascinating as opposed to a great career, is now, I guess he's an action hero. Like, I guess we've just decided that. Like, yeah. Because in some ways, like, he's sort of doing the same thing that he did in Batman vs. Superman, where it's dark origin story of comic book-esque character. And I also kind of love that this movie's character is a combination of his buddy Matt Damon's probably two most famous characters. Like, there's a little bit of Good Will Hunting in the sort of math genius part of it, but it's also kind of like Jason Bourne, where it's like, I can punch and kick and shoot and do cool stuff and like that. And yeah, it does feel like at the end of this movie that there's supposed to be a part two, which I don't want to see. I don't want to see anymore. This is not a movie where I think, well, maybe they'll get better on this second run through. The only way they could do that is they decide, we're going to spend $15 million on this. It's all going to be in CG effects and just do a lot of cool wire work and stuff like that. Otherwise, not interested.
Yes, it did make, and it was funny. It's funny you mentioned John Wick. I did mention John Wick in my review because there are a couple times where you sit, it's like, oh, that, like, even the fact that he keeps shooting people in the head.
Bingo.
Like, as basic as that is like a total, like, oh, that's just a John Wick thing. But then it just made you realize just how much better John Wick is in this. So, Grierson, what did you ultimately give this?
I gave it a C+.
Yeah, I gave it a C. I'm a little bit more down than you are. It's a muddled kind of mess, and I hope it doesn't start. So, it's a shame because, you know, I found myself kind of cheering for Ben Affleck a little bit. And I think part of that's because, A, I think he's a terrific director. I just think he's a very good director. And two, you know, we like that kind of comeback story. The guy was at as low as a career mark as you could find, but kind of built his way back, frankly, through by being a good director and then giving himself good roles and working himself back a little bit. I find myself kind of almost kind of cheery. I thought he was great in Gone Girl, and I'm like, I was glad to see that kind of happen. I'm wondering which direction he's going now. Like, I'm wondering what exactly the plan is now. Is he just Warner Brothers house guy now? He's just going to make Batman movies and fart around with this. I know he's got the next movie he directed coming out in February, but I don't know. It feels all the things that people used to criticize Affleck for, like, I remember Drew McCary had a great joke about watching The Town. He's like, man, the director really loves shots of himself shirtless, doesn't he? He really has like a lot of those in this movie. And the things that people kind of mocked him a little bit for ego-wise, I feel like he, at his best, he's able to undercut that and work, make it work for him a little bit. And my fear is with a project like this, where he's just really not quite the right fit, and casting him may have turned the movie into something different than what it was supposed to be. I just kind of wonder what kind of direction he's going.
Yeah, I think in terms of his performance, I think he kind of, to use our phrase that we use a lot on this podcast, he goes for it. And I appreciate that enough. But what's funny is that movie that you're talking about that he's going to be, that's going to be coming out, that he directed, Live by Night, is actually been pushed up to December. So somebody clearly thinks there's some sort of Oscar chance in there. So who knows? But it does feel like with The Batman, once again, the Batman, all the other Batmans step aside, that he is kind of going to be doing that now, that he's kind of like, I'm a big director, I'm a big action star, I'm going to be that guy. And the Ben Affleck that I really liked in both Gone Girl and especially Hollywood Land, which I think he's tremendous in, I do kind of wonder how much of that we're going to be seeing. And my other final thing, just to say real fast, you know, this is a movie supposed to be for grown-ups and adults can go see a movie. I don't know how satisfied they're going to be with this. I'm not even sure if it works for like older audience members will enjoy it. I'm not entirely convinced it's even for that audience either. But
yeah, now that my father is retired, I will occasionally, whenever a movie has piqued his fancy from trailers, I'll get a text from him being like, hey, what about The Accountant? You still like those movies, right? I'm like, yes, Dad, I still do. And I said, Dad, go see Deepwater Horizon. That's the one you'll actually enjoy a lot more. That audience, I think this movie is kind of ostensibly trying to get. I think Deepwater Horizon is probably the right
one. Of those two movies, I would definitely recommend Deepwater Horizon over the two. And what choices, by the way.
Yes, exactly. All right, so that is The Accountant. Maybe we'll see The Accountant 2 and go rent John Wick again. It's probably the best thing I can tell you. All right, so I'm going to step out now. Grierson is going to talk to us about Certain Women and Christine. Have a good time, Grierson. Talk all the shit you usually do.
I always will.
All right, let me know when to come back.
Okay, bye. Hello, loyal listeners. Okay, so let's talk about Certain Women.
Hey, Flint.
What are you doing here?
Came to see my lawyer.
My wife wants me out of the house.
You can't keep coming here.
Your wife works for you.
No, she's the boss, actually.
I wonder how much more there might be buried here.
Certain Women is the new film by writer director Kelly Reichert, who did Wendy and Lucy and Meek's Cutoff. And it is pretty similar if you are a fan of her earlier movies. This one is very similar in terms of the type of film and story that it is. It is in three sections, three kind of chapters, and they're all set in Montana. They're all about different women living in Montana. In the first section, a lawyer, played by Laura Dern, is dealing with a kind of annoying client, played by Jared Harris, who feels like she's not doing enough for him. He wants to sue his employer over an injury he sustained on the job. The problem is he already took money from the company as a settlement, but he feels like now it's not enough and he wants to sue them again, and you can't do that. And she tries to explain that to him. He's not happy about that. One thing leads to another. There ends up being a situation then that she has to deal with because he is unhappy with his settlement. In the second section, this woman, played by Michelle Williams, is a mother and wife who is visiting a family friend who has, we believe, dementia. He has a bunch of old sandstone at his house in the middle of nowhere in Montana, and she wants that sandstone for the dream house that she and her husband are wanting to build in Montana. And then finally, in the third section, there is this lonely rancher played by a newcomer named Lily Gladstone, who goes into town one night because she has nothing else to really do. And she stumbles upon this night class that's being taught in the town by this out-of-town lawyer played by Kristen Stewart. She is teaching all of the local teachers different aspects of law as it applies to their rights as teachers. Now, the Lily Gladstone character is not a teacher. She has no reason to be in the class, but because she has nothing else to do, she just hangs out. And because she actually really enjoys Kristen Stewart, they sort of hang out together and have dinner. The teacher comes every Tuesday and Thursday, and so every Tuesday and Thursday, the rancher comes, and they hang out and talk afterwards about their very different lives. If you're not a fan of Kelly Reichert's earlier films or haven't seen her other films, you might hear that plot description and go, God, that sounds really boring, and nothing really seems like it happens in any of those three installments. If you are a fan of her movies, you will hear that and think, oh, it's very similar to her other films, where very kind of small incidents end up being really kind of profound and revealing about just kind of everyday life and the things that we do every day that don't seem like they add up to a lot, but in the grand scheme of things actually kind of do. I am a big fan of Kelly Reichert. I've written about her, you know, back when we were at Deadspin earlier this year, The New Republic. And I think Certain Women is one of the best things that she's ever done. One of the things that she always does really well in her films is she's sort of a master in terms of creating drama and character out of silence. These characters don't say a lot, but the actions and the things that they do and the way they behave around the people in their lives tell you a lot about them. And what's part of the fun in a film like Certain Women is that not all the gaps are filled in terms of who these people are. And so the fun is trying to figure out from the clues that you see, who are these people? Watching a Kelly Reichert film, what is so kind of fascinating is that they invite you to wonder about who these people are as opposed to telling you everything. And so in some ways, you fill in the blanks yourself and how you feel versus how maybe other people see these characters can be really kind of revealing about how you see the characters versus how other audience members do. Kind of across the board, the performances are really, really tremendous. Michelle Williams is terrific. She's been in earlier Reichert films. She was in Wendy and Lucy. She was in Meek's Cutoff. And she especially, I think, is sort of attuned to the way Reichert works, where not a lot is said, not a lot is obvious, but you get a sense of character just through the simplest of acts. All three sections of the movie are really tremendous. And even though there are some small kind of connective tissue made between the three stories, this is not something like, say, Crash, where the characters keep showing up randomly in each other's stories, and that's supposed to create like a bigger sense of the world of this film. They're kind of self-contained stories, and like the best short stories, they're much bigger and richer than the sort of short length would indicate. I'm a big fan. If you can see this in a theater, I highly recommend it. It's in LA and New York right now. It's going to keep expanding around the country. It's definitely worth seeing on the big screen. I give this a very A minus. And I think this is one of the best things this year. The second film is a film called Christine.
You okay?
Do I not seem okay? Maybe you can get us some footage of the chickens having sex so people can see how the eggs are really made. That's a joke.
What is this? What are you doing?
I've just been thinking a lot about your idea of sensationalizing the news. I'm agreeing with you.
And if that title sounds familiar, other than, of course, the Stephen King book and movie, it's because there have been two movies this year about the 1970s Sarasota television news reporter named Christine Chubbuck, who was famous, sadly, for shooting herself on live television in 1974 and then dying shortly thereafter. Christine is the second of the two movies that have come out this year about this woman. The first was a documentary called Kate Plays Christine. And in that movie, the director, Robert Greene, did this very provocative thing where he cast an actress to play Christine Chubbuck in a film about Christine Chubbuck, but that documentary is actually not about the making of a movie. That documentary is actually about the questions of why we as audience members and also why filmmakers and actors are so interested in stories like this. Kate Plays Christine was very critical of our kind of gawking nature at tragedies. Why are we so fascinated in movies that recreate real life tragedies? What do we get out of that? And that movie was very inquisitive, but also very critical of us as viewers for being interested in stories like that. This movie, Christine, is directed by Antonio Campos, who a couple years ago made a movie called Simon Killer. And what Antonio Campos, I think, does very, very well in this film is, I think he very sensitively talks about the fact that if someone does something so violent and intimate and severe as not only kill themselves, but kill themselves on live television, that no movie actually really can give you the answers for why a person does that. And I think that's all to this movie's credits. It stars Rebecca Hall, who's been in everything from Vicky Cristina Barcelona to the Joel Edgerton film The Gift from a year or two ago. I've always really liked her on screen, but I think this is the best thing that she's ever done, and kind of by a wide margin. Rebecca Hall plays Christine Chubbuck, and we see about a 6 month span in Christine Chubbuck's life before she killed herself. And the movie is not about trying to tell you, oh, these are the reasons why she did it. This is what drove her to suicide. Instead, what the movie is it's almost kind of a very dark workplace comedy, not dissimilar from, say, The Newsroom or something like that, where you get the sense of how a group of people working together do their job. And so Rebecca Hall is Christine Chubbuck, and she's surrounded by the other people in this Sarasota TV news station. Dexter's Michael C. Hall plays George, who's the handsome charming news anchor for the program. Tracy Letts plays the boss of the newsroom. J. Smith Cameron plays Christine Chubbuck's mom, who is also her roommate. This is a movie, kind of like Certain Women, that's all about not explaining things, but just sort of suggesting things and letting the audience draw their own conclusions from that. I've seen Christine twice now. First time was at Sundance, and the second time was more recently when I wrote my review for The New Republic. And both times what I'm incredibly impressed and moved by in Christine is that the film only gives suggestions of what was going on in Christine's life that perhaps, and it's important to say, perhaps drove her to kill herself. She was suffering from physical ailments. She was having like these terrible stomach cramps. She was dealing with the fact that she was not happy working at this sort of low-end TV news station in Florida, where she felt like she was destined for bigger and better things. And also just in general, at least as portrayed by Rebecca Hall, she's a very awkward individual. She's not good with small talk. She's the type of person that we all know in our own lives who, you know, doesn't pick up on social cues so great, kind of has a nervous laugh, just doesn't kind of work well with other people. There's nothing necessarily wrong with them, but they're just wired a little bit differently than everybody else, and they don't have a great, easy time through life. And Rebecca Hall, I think, plays her in a way that you have such sympathy for this woman. And you kind of see very slowly, there's kind of vague references about Christine working at a news station in Boston and something bad happening there. The movie never says exactly what it is, but it's something that Christine is very embarrassed by. And you sort of get this a collection of clues about who Christine was. And there's nothing definitive about why she killed herself, but you do get a sense of a person, and a person who is smart and is talented and is driven, but just can't quite get out of her own way, who kind of keeps shooting herself in the foot over and over again. And so I think that the movie is not any sort of commentary about why people commit suicide. I think it's more just kind of this really lovely portrait about being a little bit different and kind of being lonely and what that is like when you know that if you just figured everything out, maybe you would kind of get that dream job or land the guy that you're like deeply in love with. Christine is, of course, madly infatuated with George, the TV news anchor, but that doesn't exactly work out either. And so I think that, you know, I've seen this movie twice, and both times I've thought about that Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby, and that line about all the lonely people, you know, where do they all belong? And I think Christine kind of speaks to that. And it has such compassion for this woman. Now, obviously, if you go into a movie like this, that you know that you are eventually going to see the moment where she does shoot herself on live television. And I think that Antonio Campos, the filmmaker, does a really tremendous job of not sensationalizing that, nor trying to kind of bring any kind of individual take to it. I think when we come to that moment, it is a legitimate shock, and you do feel a sense of such great sadness for this woman who didn't have to do this, but for her own reasons, felt like she couldn't find any other way out and had to do it. That is actually not the final moment in the movie, though. The final moment, which I will not reveal, I think is pretty nearly perfect in terms of how it kind of puts a period at the end of this sentence about lonely people and how the rest of us cope and deal with when there are tragedies in our lives. I give this movie also an A-. It's only playing in New York right now, and it opens in Los Angeles this upcoming week. I don't know how much it'll be expanding across the country, but I highly recommend it. And Rebecca Hall, I think, is really, really, really great in it. So both Certain Women and Christine are definitely worth checking out. If what I've described to you sounds appealing, definitely, definitely go see them. So those are my reviews. So let's go get Will right now and tell him to come back.
Hello, Grierson.
Will Leach, what are you doing here?
I know, fancy meeting a fellow like me in a place like this. Okay, let's get to our reboot section. This week's reboot movie is Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Rubbish, laddies! Get on with your work. Repeat after me. An acre is the area of a rectangle whose length is one furlong and whose width is one acre.
All right, so Pink Floyd, The Wall came out in 1982, the year that the St. Louis Cardinals won the World Series. Go Birds. Take that, Brewers. Alan is directed by Alan Parker. The animation was done by Gerald Scarfe. Do you know, am I pronouncing that correctly? Do you know? Scarfe?
That sounds right. I'm going to go with that. Or Scarfe, okay, but Scarfe doesn't sound right. So, yeah.
Scarfe. He's British, so, yeah.
Yeah.
They pronounce things weird. And of course, it is based, their screenplay is written by Roger Waters from Pink Floyd. It is one of the most famous rock musicals of all time. This was kind of the end of the heyday of rock musicals. Tommy, of course, did The Who, and then Quadrophenia, and there were a few kind of bouncing around a little bit. And this was, for better or worse, certainly the biggest statement rock musical, because it's pretty insane. It's actually pretty crazy. The plot, such as it is, based on a man named Pink, who is a rock star, much like Roger Waters. He appears to be going through some sort of emotional breakdown. He stares at his television all the time as the world kind of crumbles around him. We kind of get a little bit of his backstory, his difficulty growing up, his kind of set, and his general disgust and increasing dislike of fame. He also seems to have a drug problem. He also seems to be very obsessed with totalitarian dictatorian imagery. Just all sorts of stuff going on with Pink, who's played by Bob Geldof, who, as I went back and one of my favorite things, like, you know, to me, I will always know Bob Geldof as the Live Aid guy, like the nicest guy, the guy that the rock star for the world that wants to make the better place. That is not who he plays in this movie. He plays a much more disturbed human being. But this is, of course, really, for this movie, we can break down the plot all you want. This is really about two things. One is, of course, is the album The Wall. Pink Floyd is a concept album, musical, rock musical. The music, of course, the most famous song on here is probably Another Brick in the Wall, along with a few other songs, but I think it's probably the most famous songs. I would argue probably the most famous segment from the film. And then the over-the-top insane imagery, both live action and animated. Alan Parker is kind of a fascinating director. You know, he did a lot of he's always been kind of daring and kind of inventive and tried some new things, sometimes over the top, sometimes dialed back. This is a guy that could do a movie like Angel Heart, which is completely over the top, and then like The Commitment, which is like this charming thing that would work on like the small screen, and then Evita. And then I think after The Life of David Gale, he's like, my movies stink now. I'm not doing any movies.
If only more filmmakers said,
I know.
me, bad filmmaker, me stop.
So it would be helpful. Bugsy Malone, that's an interesting movie, Fame. Like, he's obviously made a lot of interesting movies. This is probably the one that I would argue is the most lasting. I think this is the one that people probably talk the most about out of all of those. And this is, it is very intense imagery. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on in this movie. So Grierson, I have to confess, I mentioned on last podcast, I'm not a huge Pink Floyd fan. This is not really my kind of music. But I certainly can appreciate some of the songs. Another Brick in the Wall is a great song. There's some good stuff on here. As someone that likes the music more than me, how much did that affect, better or worse, your experience of watching this movie?
Well, for me, what's funny is that, you know, I have like kind of a weird relationship with Pink Floyd. I like their music perfectly fine, but I'm entirely not invested in the stuff around their music, or specifically like what their fans think is great about Pink Floyd. Because I, you know, if you ask me to name my favorite album of all time, I would probably still pick Dark Side of the Moon. And what's very weird about that, even saying that out loud, is that I don't get caught up in, for lack of a better way of describing it, the heaviosity around that album, or frankly, the heaviosity around most Pink Floyd's music. But the reason why I like Dark Side of the Moon is it's, first of all, it's short. It's actually like 40 minutes long. When you think about concept albums, you think of these like, you know, hour and a half long, double album kind of things. Dark Side of the Moon is actually really short and really compact, and it kind of tells its story in a really nice, simple way. I like Wish You Were Here. I think that's a pretty decent album. The Wall is actually not an album I like all that much. In fact, I am a proud hater of Another Brick in the Wall since I was a kid. Even as a kid, when we were listening to like classic rock stations, and Will and I grew up together, heard a ton of classic rock on classic rock stations. This is always the song I always thought kind of sucked. And the reason why I thought it sucked, and I still think it sucks, is to me it always seems so deeply, stupidly pandering to like, hey, kids, don't you hate school? That even as a person of the age who have been like most susceptible, I went, dude, don't pander to me. It was like, that to me was their version of like, Mattoonoli rocks. Like, don't fool me. I'm on to you. I much prefer Run Like Hell and Comfortably Numb. But to me, this, just before even, I realize I haven't answered your question yet, but even like this album, to me, gets into the concept album rock, like opera kind of problem, which is finally there's an album about how hard it is to be a rock star, which is
at last.
I was just having a conversation with a buddy of mine a couple days ago about this. We were talking about The Wall. I was like, so what is it? Because The Wall is not the only one that does this, but what is it about rock stars where they want to tell us that being famous sucks? And I think that what it is, you know, in my heart of hearts, what I think they're trying to say is like, listen, you as listeners probably think that my life as a rock star is perfect and I have no problems and everything is great. Well, actually, there's a lot of things that actually are a lot tougher when you're a rock star, because for instance, it doesn't take away from the things that you thought would be better. Like if I become famous, then this problem will go away and this problem will go away, like with my family issues or whatever. And I understand that, I guess, sort of emotionally and intellectually, but just speaking for The Wall, now I'm going to segue into the movie. Boy, you've got to sit through a lot of people complaining about stuff that's not interesting. And it's, you know, this is a movie that Christopher Nolan likes a lot and has used as a reference, not like one-to-one comparisons for his movies, but, you know, he watches this movie as inspiration when he's getting ready to do something. And I really like Christopher Nolan's movies, and I think there's an intellectualization that goes on in this movie that maybe he responds to. But for me, this movie is kind of the old music video problem, which is, there are great segments that I find incredibly arresting. Run Like Hell is really great. Comfortably Numb is really great. And there are individual moments of just striking imagery or striking music that makes you get a sense of the grandeur of the overall thing. But those isolated moments are then undercut by, God, Bob Geldof is not a very compelling presence. And Boy, is his story just not that interesting. I know the animation is cool and there are, like, you know, you get a sense of, I will say that I was never bored watching this. I was never bored, but there were many times I thought to myself, I should probably be on something, right? This would probably, that would connect the dots in a way. And so while I don't want to trash the movie entirely, because it, I mean, to use a stupid, like, you know, critical thing, it's something. I mean, this movie's definitely something. It is legitimately something. And I think if I saw this movie, we talked about this with Barry Lyndon, I think it applies here for a completely different movie. If you saw this on the big screen with a packed audience, you would get more out of this movie. I think there's no question that communal experience would inform the film in a way. I watched it at home when my wife was on her computer not really paying attention, which is not the same thing. And so for me, it's like isolated, interesting moments and overall thinking, yeah, this is not quite for me.
Yeah, it's got some, a couple things. One, this is a movie that actually has the rock star trashes a hotel room cliche scene, but takes it with the utmost deathly seriousness. And to me, that's generally one of the major issues I have with the movie is this. I don't really find Roger Waters' anguish as compelling as Roger Waters finds it. Is probably the best way
it is, to put that. It is mathematically impossible.
I think. So the idea that there's actually a slow motion rock star trashing the hotel, and there's not like a slight wink back to be like, I know, rock stars are kind of assholes. I get it. Like, there's none of that. There's none of that at all, which brings me back to another issue with the movie. And again, I don't want to be all 2006 problematic guy, but man, this movie's got some issues with women. Man, this movie has got some serious issues with women. Some of it's very compelling. I feel like one of the most striking images is of one of the animation scenes where basically, I think in Ebert and his Great Movies review, this was on his Great Movies, by the way. He played this at Ebert Fest, by the way. Where basically, as I think he put it, it is a Georgia O'Keeffe nightmare that is like a flower actually becomes an evil killing monster while looking like the reproductive system of a woman. It is serious business, and it's all guys being scared. Woman's gonna destroy you. It really is. It's so raw and like powerful that it is not something that it's something that clearly Waters feels very deeply. And the movie, I think, does a good job of trying to get into that dark place where he's at. I just don't find that dark place as he's at all that compelling, interesting. And frankly, a lot of it's kind of like, yeah, dude, you might be a little bit of a dick.
Yeah, I could not talk about 2016 perspective. I could not watch this movie without thinking, boy, wasn't it good that the rock era kind of ended? Because there is a, you know, to give the movie its due, I think that all of the, and I agree the problematic is a kind way of sort of putting it, that there is a genuineness about being freaked out about women from that song Mother on, kind of this idea of not knowing how to have relationships with women and being freaked out by women. And there is something time capsule-y meaningful about saying like, look, this is the way rock star men who were treated like gods and got to have as much sex as they wanted. This is kind of the way that these were their attitudes. This is the way they acted around these things. And that is kind of fascinating. It's not like we don't have our own problems today, but you watch it that and you think, boy, this was an era where not only did these kinds of stars kind of like roam the universe free, it was kind of considered meaningful that whatever they thought meant something. They weren't just rock stars. They were like artists and poets, and they had deep thoughts about all these things. Now, of course, the album came out in 79. This comes out in 82. You've got punk. You've got the beginnings of hip hop. So it's not like rock is entirely dominating the world. But this is the kind of rock music that you're like, yeah, having less of this around is not the worst thing in the world.
Well, it's the kind of pomposity that, the line from Tommy to this to November Rain, like this is a lot. Like, to me, I mentioned going back to bringing Kurt Cobain back to the beginning of the podcast, that kind of thing. I think that was, to me, one of the things that was so appealing about Nirvana is it stopped a lot of that shit. And like, it just kind of, and not that Kurt Cobain didn't have his own problems, to say the least, but like that kind of indulgent assholeness, to me, like, I'm glad that that's gone.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, and this would be its own kind of interesting conversation just in general, but what's funny about someone like Kurt Cobain is like, there's a lot of complicated women issues that are going on with him as well, and almost kind of like him feeling like he wants to counteract a certain type of rock star male sexism, but in his own way kind of stumbling a little bit. But I agree. Obviously, Cobain was worlds smarter and much more self-critical than someone like Roger Waters was. But to me, what's funny, and I don't want to go too far down this road, but we're both big Radiohead fans. And of course, when OK Computer came out, people kind of called it like the dark side of the moon of its time and all that stuff. you know, maybe 20 years from now or 30 years from now, we'll look back at OK Computer or Kid A and say, oh God, thank God that era is over, because boy, were they so pompous. But I gotta say, even Thom Yorke at his most kind of navel-gazing, it didn't have the same kind of male ego strut that I think this thing kind of has. And it doesn't, like, that alone doesn't make me, like, dislike The Wall as a movie, but it is funny how we both kind of picked up on the sense of, like, dude, come on. Like, yeah. It's okay, you know. It's not the go take a walk. It'll be all right, you know. So yeah,
and I do think, and just kind of like give something positive to wrap up a little bit. I do feel like the last, particularly the animation, the last 15 minutes of it, where it kind of turns into, you know, Pink is kind of imagining himself as this fascist leader, and I feel like some of those scenes were more immediately familiar than I would necessarily have thought they would have been. I'll put it that way.
Too soon.
Yes, there's certainly some recent news events that maybe didn't make this feel like it was a little bit less ancient history. So I feel like a lot of that's really compelling. There's a lot of great images. I think when there's like the hammers marching is very strong. And like that stuff's over the top. And I think kind of the movie gets a little off the rails. But I feel like that's a good, like, it's certainly compelling and something to absorb.
Yeah, I think what is... You've hit on the thing that I think that is best about The Wall, which is that that movie and the album, but the movie especially, is a warning about, like, the old Bob Dylan line about don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters. This idea of don't look at me, Bob Geldof playing Pink Floyd, don't look at me as a leader, because that way will only lead to disaster. And if you are following me, how easy is it for you to follow another person who can tell you to do these horrible things simply because I have the cult of personality and I'm a famous person? That element, the where it kind of ends as it being kind of a warning to the listener of, or the viewer, I guess, in this case, of, hey, don't look to me. I don't have the answers for you. I'm famous, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm like, I'm good at music, but that doesn't mean I can tell you anything. That's the strongest part of the movie. And that to me is the thing that I think, again, to give Roger Waters the benefit of the doubt, I think that is ultimately the point of why he's complaining so much about being famous. It's more complicated than that. But I think it takes a long time to get to that. And you have to kind of suffer through a lot that's not very profound to get to that point.
All right. So anything else you want to add? I feel like I'm glad I watched it. I'd never seen it. I'm glad I watched it. But it definitely, here's a good thing about it. Again, I'm not a big Pink Floyd fan, and this did not inspire me to run out and listen to some Pink Floyd. And I feel like even movies that, you know, even movies that have been about artists that I, you know, movies I don't even like that much sometimes, they'll inspire me to get a little bit more about an artist. I felt thinking, you know what? I know Grierson loves Dark Side of the Moon. I feel like I have them properly rated.
You know, it's you. If you're a Dark Side of the Moon fan, you can catch the reference to their hit song "Money" in the movie and go, "Hey, they're talking about money." But I've listened to a couple more songs from The Wall since watching this, just because I was kind of curious to re-listen to it. But I think I'm going to stick to stuff I'm currently enjoying and not dive back into the catalog. But Dark Side of the Moon is still tremendous. I still stand behind that album.
All right, so Dark Side of the Moon. Go listen to that, and with Wizards of Oz, of course. You've done that, of course, because that's why you love the album so much.
I've still never done that. That would be the greatest of all of our reboot requests.
Don't give them any ideas, Grierson. I don't want to do that.
Man, you're such a square, man. Come on.
I am definitely a square.
You're so basic.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. Boom roasted. What can I tell you?
Yeah, yes. What I appreciate about the Grierson and Leach podcast is they use terrible slang from the past and the present in their conversations. So basic,
exactly.
Basic and square, yes.
Yes, exactly. Dope. All right, so that is
word.
By the way, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I got to get back to this.
Yes,
we have been numbering this thing wrong. So it's actually been numbered wrong in two different places. One, if you go to the New Republic, we get we have a post that announces each new podcast on the New Republic. Those numbers are really wrong. We have like 235s. There's like a 36. Currently, I think it's only on 36. But last week we said we were on episode 37, but we actually went back and. This would be my fault because I'm the one that puts together the show notes for this. I apparently had forgotten to switch the number on one. This is episode 39. Last week I mentioned it was episode 37. It wasn't. It was 38. This is episode 39. So I'm sure all of our loyal listeners on the constantly updated, fan-updated wiki of the Greatest of the Least podcast. I'm sure they've had this. They've been waiting. They're finally all doing shots because, like, Greatest of the Least finally discovered that their episode numbers are wrong, but they have been wrong. This is episode 39. We apologize for the mistake.
Yes, I knew I should have kept looking back at that Reddit thread about our podcast because I would have noticed this weeks ago. I feel like I wish this was this type of thing, like, every once in a while when like an album liner notes, they put the songs in the wrong order and then they correct it. And then if you got like one of the original messed up copies, that'd be worth more. There's nothing in terms of this podcast that kind of is equivalent to that. So
yeah, this is like the Billy Ripken baseball card with fuck face on the end of the bat.
Yes.
You've seen that baseball card.
Yeah. Of course I did. How many, that was it Fleer? Was that Fleer?
Yeah,
how many damn packs of Fleer did I buy in the off chance I would get that thing? The answer was too many, and I never ended up getting it on any of them. So,
I met Billy Ripken one time on the MLB Network set, and I started to ask him about the card, and before I got like three words in, he's like, "Don't ask me about the card. It's the only thing that cares about me and my." Don't ask me about the card. So I didn't ask about the card.
That's not the only thing we care about.
Yeah. Also, your brother. Yes, we literally care about nothing else. All right. So that was the Greatest of the Least podcast episode 39.
It's 39. It's, we apologize. 39. It is 39. Yes.
Yes, so which means, hey, we get the big 4-0.
Will we start lying, by the way, next week and keep saying it's episode 39?
We're turning 39 for the third straight time.
Yes.
So next week, speaking of next week, we will have two major reviews. One review that I will ask Grayson questions about because it's a movie I don't care about seeing as much as the two I saw this we had this week. And then one reboot. Our major movies are, first up is Moonlight, which is written and directed by Barry Jenkins, starring Naomi Harris, Trevante Rhodes, Ashton Sanders. I can never say this guy's name. He's the guy. It's the guy from House of Cards, Mahershala Ali. And it is about it's a difficult thing to describe. It is about a kind of a young man in Miami who kind of follow his life as he tries to discover who he is in a difficult situation growing up. I'm very excited to talk about this. We've both seen that, so we have much to discuss. I'll be reviewing that for the New Republic this week. Also, we'll be discussing Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. I think I called it Never Look Back. Is this Never Go Back? It, like, that is a subtitle that's going to get messed up a lot.
I have to tell you that even as you said Never Go Back, I thought, is that right? Because I have decided that there's no way I'm going to remember it. It's impossible.
According to the wiki, it was actually 6 months ago called Never Look Back. So apparently the people that came up with the title have had the same problem.
I'm just going to call it Jack Reacher 2, and that's fine.
The Deuce. Exactly.
The Deuce. The Deuce. I hope there's a character named The Deuce in this movie. That would be.
but no Werner Herzog, I think, this
no,
time.
No Werner. No. Maybe it's like his twin brother shows up or something to avenge him.
Exactly. Or I just hope his character from Parks and Recreation shows up. Also, I will be asking Grierson questions about American Pastoral, which is the directorial debut of Ewan McGregor, also stars Jennifer Connelly, and is the adaptation of the aforementioned Philip Roth, his book. You saw that in Toronto, right?
That is correct.
And I have not seen it. I'm probably not going to get to that one anytime soon, so I'm just going to comfortably ask Grierson questions about that. And what better transition from Philip Roth can we have to our reboot movie? Our reboot movie next week is... Drum roll, please.
I was going to say ellipsis, ellipsis, ellipsis. Yes.
Weekend at Bernie's, our movie next week. Our reboot movie is Weekend at Bernie's, the 1989 comedy starring Jonathan Silverman, Andrew McCarthy, and Terry Kaiser as the eponymous and quite dead Bernie Lomax. So we're going to be talking. So we're going to go. We're going to go from Moonlight to Tom Cruise to Philip Roth to Weekend at Bernie's. This should be a fun show next week, Chris.
Yes, there. I feel like there's going to be several trigger warnings we should have for next week's podcast. But yes, I'm very excited. I'm very excited.
We have to install airbags, like be flooring it and crashing it real fast. All right, so Grissom, good show in episode 39 of this podcast. Have a great week, Grissom. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, by the time we talk to you next, the Chicago Cubs menace will have been extinguished, and we'll be able to have a Los Angeles. Because you realize, Grissom, if the Los Angeles, another reason I know America is rooting for the Cubs, but if the Dodgers win this series, we will probably be able to do a Grissom and Leach live, which I think would be very exciting.
Our second live episode.
Exactly. So go Dodgers, stop the earth from crashing into the sun.
And just to remind everybody, we are Cardinal fans, and that's why we are not rooting for the Cubs. Because we are
also because it will be the end of life as we know. But anyway, all right, Grissom, have a great week. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, bye.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teachers leave.
I don't have any sympathy for Chicago Cubs fans because they don't even give a fuck. They've only given a fuck for like the last 10 years. But other than that, it's just been take your shirt off and let's have a keg party. Nobody cares. They're almost like an honorary baseball team. Like, just represent the fact that people like the game. Chicago Cubs fans do not give a shit. All right? So if you're a tourist, if you ever go to Chicago and you run into somebody, you know, and they got a passion for what they're doing, that's a White Sox fan. If you run into just some fucking jerk off, you know, sitting there wearing loafers with no socks, you know, and some silly fucking Let's Play 2 hat, that is a Cubs fan. And they are not to be respected.